Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. The 2013-14 Arts Spree season has had an interesting variety of artists, starting with mezzo-soprano Sasha Cook, already making headlines with the Metropolitan Opera, then Russian guitarist Roshvan Mehmedkuliv, prize winner of the Guitar Foundation of America, followed by another Russian, pianist Nikita Mendoyants, finalist in last year's Cliburn competition, then the Chinese folk orchestra from the Qingdao University of Science and Technology, and on April the 6th, to close the series, internationally acclaimed jazz saxophonist Steve Owen. He is also director of jazz studies at the University of Oregon, so teacher, composer, arranger, and performer. Caught on the wing, as it were, the following conversation covers a number of aspects of the saxophone and his connection to it.
Started off, I think, in military bands. I think they wanted an instrument that would compete as a woodwind with the brass. Adolf Sachs originally thought it would be just a wonderful solo instrument with orchestra. Well, obviously, it didn't find its home there. It has been interesting to see how it's evolved. It has a tremendous voice in jazz.
But even now, it's heard much more in classical music.
Yeah, it is. And although I haven't spent time studying classical saxophone for a number of years now, just because my job's taken me more towards the jazz side of things, mm-hmm. I initially started as a classical saxophonist, and it's a beautiful instrument. I think one of the things that's, at least for me, and I think for a lot of saxophonists, I think the skill sets involved between the two, while there are, technically a lot of things are shared between the two styles, it's kind of difficult to maintain competency in both areas.
Yeah,
it's a pretty demanding instrument on either side. So,
which one do you play most? Because they have about four sizes, don't they?
You know, I started on alto saxophone. I started on clarinet, actually, after I started, step back from there. I started on piano and then moved to clarinet. And then we had a stage band at the time at our high school, and I dearly wanted to be in that group. And so they needed a saxophonist, so I started saxophone in the ninth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And have been playing it ever since. But I started on an alto saxophone, but at present for the last few years I've been focusing more on playing tenor saxophone. It's an interesting, it's a little bit different voice, especially in the jazz world. Performance practices is considerably different on the two.
Is it more adaptable to speed and variation of tone?
Well, what I find is that the vocabulary that the improvisers use is a little bit different. I think the lines, the improvisational lines tend to be a little bit more angular,
mm-hmm.
maybe with tenor saxophonists. And I was kind of drawn to that. And I found, as I find with studying most jazz, whether it's composition or performance, I find I like to transcribe a lot. And so through transcription of both, those, I felt I needed to be playing tenor to be transcribing tenor saxophone. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, I've been doing it for a while now.
But you started composing quite young.
Did you have
the ability and love of improvisation even early on when you were playing with compositions and on instruments that were appealing to you?
You know, it's interesting, but I didn't. I started improvising, not really seriously improvising, until I was in college,
mm-hmm.
Working on it. But I'd been writing for quite a while. I was lucky enough to have an older brother who's a very fine composer, who showed me the ropes when I was, I guess it was the end of junior high school. And so both my brother and I would write music for that stage band.
Is he still a working musician?
Yes, and he's a very fine one. In fact, he was just up for a Grammy in the jazz area this last year.
Have the two of you diverged slightly into different styles and ideas?
Well, it's funny. We certainly are in different locations.
Where
he's
is
been
he?
In Florida. He's been in Florida for the past 30 years, and I've been on the West Coast now for almost the same amount of time. So, but no, he writes for jazz ensembles, but he's been doing more writing for orchestra as well. He wrote for the, he used to work with Eric Klunzel and the Boston Pops. And he used to do a lot of pops writing, but he always wanted to do more serious writing for orchestra. So his more recent pieces have been for different types of jazz groups along with orchestra.
Has he written any kind of concerto-style music for orchestra?
Yeah, in fact, he just completed a concerto. He had Guggenheim to do that. So he finished that recently. It was a concerto for jazz guitar and saxophone and orchestra.
Gosh.
That was the piece, that was a CD that was up for a Grammy this past year or so.
That's the one you mentioned, yes. Well, that's exciting. It's interesting that the two of you are still there with the saxophone, but with slightly different emphases.
Yeah, I think if you were to talk to my brother, he'd say, well, he'd probably tell you that that Steve's more of the player, a little bit more of a player, and he's almost exclusively a composer. I still wouldn't call myself a player first. I've always been a composer first. But
have you written for
I like to play. I think I work at it probably more than he does at this point.
Have you written for each other?
You know, no. And it's odd, but we've talked about a few different types of projects that we might be involved with. In fact, I think, you know, that's probably going to come down the line sooner rather than later now. It's odd that since both of us have been doing it so long, but we haven't collaborated on much. I think probably the only collaboration we've ever done is when I first started writing and he was a little older than I. He arranged a couple of my compositions.
Well, that's something to look back on and enjoy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The voice of the saxophone was one of the things that I read about, that the larger one, it has such a dominant, mellow sound that can compete with the louder, more resonant instruments of a marching band. And that's one of the reasons it became so popular so quickly in the band world. But in the terms of the sound in an orchestra or a jazz combo or whatever the ensemble is that you play with most, is the larger one not quite so effective? The tenor one is slightly, or is that the largest you can play?
Oh, there's a baritone saxophone and actually a bass saxophone, which isn't written for very often. And they're very rare instruments. But of the common saxophones, there's soprano, which is soprano, alto, tenor, and baritone saxophone.
Right.
So, you know, and I've been playing tenor for a while. And it is interesting. I think, especially kind of comparing the orchestral side or classical side of saxophone with the jazz side of saxophone, I'd probably say one of the most unique differences between the two is that in the jazz world, I think most people are trying to find a sound that might be unique to themselves. And so it's kind of an odd instrument, and especially in writing for I write for larger jazz ensembles a lot. You don't necessarily have a group of homogenous sounds in a saxophone section. You might have things that are, you know, people's sounds are very unique and different, and so writing for them, you have to really take that into account because they. You know, I think great players will do a good job of balancing and blending, but it's unusual. You're definitely writing for a group of characters, I think, when you write for a jazz ensemble.
So, yeah, I can see that would be so. But I was wondering, while you were talking, there are so many new trends of music composition in all areas, whether it's Metallica or the classical regular orchestral pieces, that the sound of the saxophone is so apparent in a smaller ensemble anyway. But do you find that you are setting things now, slightly different styles and harmonies, experimenting to see how they fit with what other people are doing?
Well, yeah. I mean, in fact, Well, as part of my job, I teach at the University of Oregon. Mm-hmm. Part of my job there, I'm heavily involved with the students on the composition side who are they're primarily jazz writers. But it's loosely defined as jazz anymore. I had a very fine student who has an ensemble that he writes for. That the ensemble is it has saxophone in it, but it has cello and bassoon and a percussionist and saxophone and trumpet. And the music, I don't think you could really describe it as jazz as we think of jazz. I think it's probably more improvised classical type music or chamber music. But we find more and more and more of that. I think it opens up all sorts of interesting avenues. I will say, I think orchestrationally, you know, from the composition side, it puts real demands on the performers when you're working kind of unrelated families of instruments, because sometimes the sonically they don't balance as well as others do. But it's interesting, and some of the music that's been coming out by people who write for these mixed ensembles, just beautiful.
What sort of a program will you bring here?
Well, I'm actually doing two different programs. We're performing in a combo setting for the Art Spree concert, and we'll be putting together. I think we'll be playing some standards and maybe a few arrangements that I've done of some of standards, and then maybe a couple of originals. But it looks, I think, a couple of the other musicians in the group are bringing pieces as well. So I'm not sure. We're going to meet when I first get into town, and we're going to see what we can throw together.
That was Steve Owen, jazz saxophonist, also director of jazz studies at the University of Oregon, a composer and arranger. He will close the UALR Art Spree 2013-14 season, joined in concert by Michael Karrenbauer guitar, Michael Underwood trombone, Tom Cox piano, Bill Huntington bass, and Brian Brown drums, at 3 p.m. Sunday, April the 6th, in the Stella Ballsmith Concert Hall at UALR. For tickets, call the box office 501-569-8993. This afternoon at 3, the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra Youth Orchestra Rock Concert at Wildwood Park for the Arts brings rock and classic music to a program with violinist Rachel Barton Pine as soloist under the youth orchestra conductor Jeff Robson. Arkansas Rep's Les Miserables continues through April the 6th. Weekend theater production of Tuesdays with Maury opens April the 4th and runs Fridays and Saturdays 7:30 through April the 19th with a 2:30 matinee April the 13th. In Conway, the UCA Opera Theater presents three nights of opera, April 3rd through 6th, A Hand of Bridge, The Telephone, and Pizza con Funghi, Pizza with Mushrooms, 7:30 in Reynolds Performance Hall. In Fayetteville, catch Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Wizard of Oz, April 1st through 6th in the Walton Arts Center, followed by Roseanne Cash, April the 7th. April the 3rd at the University of Arkansas, pianist Jura Margulis gives a recital in Ozark Hall in the Honors College Student Lounge. 5 p.m. pre-concert talk, 6 p.m. performance, and then a reception at 7. April the 4th in Searcy, Harding University's Lyceum Series presents the Arkansas Symphony's Chamber Orchestra, 7 p.m. in the Administration Auditorium. There's an Irish guitar quartet coming to Little Rock today in the Christ Episcopal Church concert series. Other artists have included Quink and Anonymous Four, so you can be sure the four young Irishmen of the Dublin guitar quartet will be well worth hearing. I was able to reach one of them, Brian Bolger, last Monday, and get some background history of the group, who met as students at the Dublin Conservatory of Music and Drama.
We met in college, yeah, for the first time. We kind of all lumped in together as guitarists, and then kind of decided to form ranks a little bit because the guitar tends to be instrument, I suppose, in the classical academic side. Anyway, I know Julian Bream, the famous English guitarist, really had to fight for his place as a guitarist on his performance degree. I believe he had to do it on piano. I'm not even sure he was allowed to
do
his final recital on guitar. So that was, I think that would have been the 60s, maybe, maybe earlier 50s. So in terms of, you know, the history of classical music, it's still kind of an outsider's instrument. So I suppose we just kind of got together and just... I think one of the big problems for us was the lack of repertoire. So the best way to do that for us was to make arrangements. And once that door opened, we could make arrangements of string quartets and that and find some music for, you know, to play.
Right, right. And I think there's a mention about you'd organized or arranged Philip Glass quartets from string quartet to guitar, and he was very impressed with what you'd done, which was great. I was doing my music degrees in the mid-60s, and you were quite right that the one time, I think, that Julian Bream did come to Dallas, he was a great favorite of all the guitar players, but not many people knew of him. And the university I went to was Southern Methodist in Dallas, and it had started the year I started with conferring a bachelor in guitar, classic guitar, which was one of the first universities in the country, I think, to do so. Had you brought yourselves to the conservatory on scholarship to learn more about music in general, or had you all been, when you got to the university, the conservatory, find that there was, you had so much in common in how you yourselves had developed a love for and a skill in playing the guitar?
I think, you know, when we went to college quite young, so any kind of expectations, I suppose, or big kind of career plan, as you're kind of implying there, wasn't really what we were doing. We were, supposed we were just there to study music and learn about music in general. I heard Philip Glass really for the first time in during my degree. So there was no plan as such, you know, to do what we're doing now. It was pure education, I suppose, pure education,
And then you both, all four of you, when you did get together and begin to talk and play together and think about things, realized that this was where you had to go, was to set your own path and find people who would write for you or write your own repertoire?
We haven't really written any of our own stuff. Tend to, for the most part, make arrangements of... we wanted to distinguish ourselves from the other guitar quartets, which would, you know, perform music of every era, I suppose, with some Baroque music and, you know, Bach arrangements and even arrangements of, like, Carmen and that sort of thing. And there's lots of quartets doing that very well, and that's all, you know, fine. But we wanted to do something, a kind of a guitar version almost of, say, the Arditi Quartet or the Kronos Quartet, like a modern... a modern guitar, kind of a serious ensemble for guitar.
And there are people, I don't know too many of them, but we've got a very fine guitar chairman of the department here that teaches both classic and jazz and some of the early ones. And Django Reinhardt is the one that he quotes most often in his programs and things.
So
those are things that I imagine came across and you thought, well, this might be fun, and then see where you go from there.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of the music we play would be the kind of established composers, minimalist or post-minimalist, or they don't like to be referred to by those terms, but that kind of era, you know, guys who established themselves in the 60s as something that's taken that radical direction away from serialism and atonality and to kind of go back to raw repetition and tonal sense, clear tonal centers.
But when composers like, for example, you mentioned Glass, and then Steve Reich has written a lot for the Kronos, but they are string. He hasn't written specially for guitar, has he?
He's written a solo piece for Pat Metheny, the famous jazz guitarist, called Electric Counterpoint. And that's for soloist and tape, pre-recorded tape. And on the tape, I think there's another 11 instruments, 11 guitars, including a bass guitar, electric bass guitar. And we're performing that as part of the concert. So that's a very interesting piece, yeah. And a very interesting composer and very radical composer as well.
Well, we've got a very impressive local orchestra and chamber music ensemble, and they played the Villa-Lobos for 10 cellos. And last season, it was just wonderful to listen to. And I was thinking that new composers for the guitar would probably be a richer field in the new world, in South America, than in Europe at the moment.
We did a tour in Colombia, and pretty much anybody we came into contact with, like the guy sending emails to, you know, the administration, he'd also send us his guitar quartet he wrote. You know, so there's a lot of interest there in guitars. Yeah.
Have you commissioned works from composers specifically for the guitar?
We have commissioned we commissioned Kevin Volans, who's a South African composer. He's written for the Kronos Quartet. His music originally was very African influenced. We commissioned him kind of later in his on a later period, I suppose. And he wrote a piece called Four Guitars, which is a very austere work. Who else have we commissioned? David Flynn is an Irish composer. He wrote us an African piece, which we'll be playing, called Chimarenga. And we've commissioned Donica Dennehy, who's an Irish composer.
I wondered how you pronounced that.
What's that, sorry?
I wondered how you pronounced that name.
Donica Dennehy, Donica, the first one is history. Yeah. That was a piece for electric guitar quartet. And we're working on a piece now with Michael Gordon, the composer from New York, a piece for four electric guitars. Yeah.
So, do you play with your electronic hookup to the guitar when you're on tour?
Yeah, we have this kind of subtle amplification, these acoustic amps that are just kind of on, adding a bit of kind of presence and bringing us up to the volume of a violin or a cello.
Right.
Because the guitar isn't as loud, and the halls are, you know.
No, we've had
four string instruments and kind of pianos and stuff, so we need to kind of match that.
Yes, we've got a guitar soloist on our next season with the symphony, so it'll be interesting to see what she does with that. But the composers that are mentioned in your bio that I got off the web, the only names I really recognize in regards to new works, new composers later than the 1950s. We mentioned Glass and Reich, and Alva Peart, and then the whole list of names I've never even heard of before.
Okay, I'll have to look at that list. I'm not sure to who you're referring, but maybe they're Irish composers. Or, we did a lot of commissioning earlier on of
Irish composers. But the new music for a lot of us, myself included, was 1900s to 1950s. You know, when I first started getting interested in this, Benjamin Britten was a young man.
Stravinsky
made a little bit. But the way it has gone since then, our ears have become so much more accustomed to the sound of those new music compositions that they no longer sound so strange. You listen to a bit of Alban Berg right now, and his lyric suite is very popular. And you think, this is lovely music, where before it was so discordant to ears brought up on four-part harmony and things like that.
You develop a taste for it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, what are you bringing with you when you come to Christchurch?
We're going to play some Ligeti, as you were talking about that era. We're going to play his Musica, selected movements, there's a lot of movements, of his Musica Ricicarta, also known as the Six Bagatelles, which he extracted from the Musica Ricicarta. They're a lovely set of pieces. They're very schizophrenic, almost, kind of folksy, jazzy, and then quite avant-garde and modernist, and then... it's quite a mixed bunch of pieces, and we love to play that. That was originally written for piano, solo piano, and then we heard a version for saxophone quartet. So we've kind of adapted that, and we went back to the original piano piece. We're playing some music by Arvo Pärt, the Estonian composer, some choral music, some kind of devotional music. We're playing electric counterpoint for electric guitar and tape by Steve Wright. And we are playing some Cuban music, Cuban composer called Leo Brewer, called Cuban Landscape with Rain, which is a programmatic piece in that it evokes the onset and climax of a rainstorm. What else have we got? Oh, we're actually playing a piece by an Irish rock band here called the Redneck Manifesto. They're like what would be known as a post-rock band or an art-rock band, also influenced by some of the other composers we're playing. They're influenced by Steve Reich and Philip Glass as well, in a way. Did I get through everything? I think so.
And is it, as a group of four, do you at times have a soloist where the other three make harmonies below it or keep accompaniment as opposed to just all having the same kind of voice?
A lot of the music we play would be fairly fairly kind of equal in that respect. Like Steve Wright, for example, even though that piece is a solo piece, instruments tend to merge together and patterns are kind of played out of phase and they're interlocking. And, you know, that's a very African idea as well, where you have like independent voices and they have independent rhythms and independent kind of bar lengths. We'll be playing some music like that. So the idea of very clear melody and accompaniment, we wouldn't have too much of that kind of Mozartian stuff going on. But there, you know, all of the music is quite melodic and it's a little bit more homophonic in places. But it's quite melodic and tuneful music that we like to choose sometimes. Because that's quite dynamic. There's a lot of oscillations, I suppose, in like mood and timbre and you know, tempi and that. Like one piece might be, say, as I said, an arrangement of a choral piece, a very lovely choral piece, and then the next piece would be quite jazzy, and then we've a piece of African music, and then a piece of Cuban music, and then some electronic guitar music, and, you know.
That sounds like great.
Kind of mixed, yeah.
Well, it's fascinating reading also that you've got now, in 2004, for example, you had the inaugural guitar festival. Then you've got the Dublin Electronic Arts Festival. And it's also interesting, your African connection. It sounds as though you're exploring every place you can. And to have a guitar festival implies that the guitar is getting some foothold in Ireland.
Yeah, there's an annual festival here. Guitar Festival of Ireland. They've had quite a few people over. They've had John Williams. They've had us. We actually played the very first concert during the day as a lunchtime concert. I always argue I think it might be the most popular instrument that ever was.
Brian Bolger is a member of the Dublin Guitar Quartet, which comes to Little Rock today for a performance at 3:30 p.m. in Christ Episcopal Church on Scott Street. Tickets available at the door. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.